My aim is simply to give an account of real definitions. I'm going to do so in terms of two notions, a notion of identity and a notion of grounding. I say a notion of identity because it's not the standard notion of identity, and a notion of grounding because I take there to be several relevant notions of grounding. I'm just going to use one for the purpose of the account. So this presentation develops an idea that has been extremely briefly suggested in a manuscript that I recently wrote with a colleague of mine, Alex Kiles. So this is the idea is really to try do the best I could to develop the suggestion. There's a big appendix, five slides. Five dense slides that constitute the bonus, where I'm going to present an account of what I call representational grounding. So that's basically the notion of grounding that people like Kit Fine and Gideon Rosen have in mind when they talk about grounding. So I'm not sure I will have time to go through that up. To me, this is probably the most exciting part of the presentation. So I hope I have time to talk about that. All right. So I will take real definitions, at least to start with. To be statements of a form to be F is to be G, so the index DF is taken to indicate a definition, where F and G are predicate expressions. So you have here examples: to be human is to be a rational animal, to be water is to be a substance composed of H2O molecules, or again, to know that P is to have justified true belief that P. Okay, so that's going to be, from some time at least, the general form of a real definition. Now, when people try to explain what's characteristic of these statements, of these definitions, they tell you, well, a real definition is not a definition of a word or of a concept, it's a definition of a worldly property, of a feature, okay? So if you take the first case, what's supposed to be defined here is not the word human or the notion of being human, it's really the feature of being human, or perhaps the kind of humanity somehow. Okay. So that's the usual gloss on this idea of a real definition. Okay. Now there is supposed to be a strong connection between real definition and essence. So real definition purports to reveal the essence of a property or a feature, to tell us what having the property consists in. So Katrin Kosnicki puts it nicely as follows: the definition must be explanatory of the essential nature of the definiendum, i.e. The property. Okay. So this is to give you an idea of what I'm talking about today. Now, this being said, there's a question, one question as to what real definitions define, if they define anything. So perhaps the standard view is that they define properties that corresponds to the usual, you know, familiar gloss on real definitions. So for instance, the real definition to be human is to be a rational animal defines the property of being human, full stop. Okay. Now there are problems with this view on real definitions. And I here mention two problems. One problem is that this view excludes nominalism. So you cannot be a nominalist and at the same time accept as correct or true real definitions. Why? Because you don't believe in properties. Okay. Now this is really bad, because I take it that a nominalist can definitely accept that, for instance, to be human is, in relevant sense, to be a rational animal. Okay. So that's one problem with this account of real definitions. Another problem is that in some cases you do have real definitions that seem to be correct, but there cannot possibly be the corresponding property. So if you take this real definition to be a non-self-instantiator is to fail to instantiate oneself, then if you admit the existence of the property of being a non-self-instantiator, then you are going to a resonant paradox. Okay. So correct or true real definition, but there cannot possibly be a corresponding property. So these are two reasons to reject the view that real definitions define properties. So if they don't define properties, what do they define? So here's the second view, nothing, okay? And I think this is the correct view. The thought here is that what you have here in this statement, you know, is a predicate human, to be human. There's no, you know, nominal expression that purports to, you know, refer to anything. So prima facie, there's no, you know, reason to think that there should be, you know, reference properties involved here. The view goes further and says, well, in fact, there's absolutely, such statements do not commit one to properties at all. The consequence of the view is that saying that a real definition defines a worldly property of things is potentially misleading, but it's actually okay in informal speech, and I'm going to talk like that during the talk, because otherwise the formulation is quite difficult to follow, okay? All right. Okay, so here are two principles about real definitions, which I take to be correct and to be constitutive of the idea of a real definition. Okay, so the first one is I call the identity principle, IP, and it says that if to be F is to be G, then being F and being G are one and the same. And I'm going to use that symbol here to express that form of identity. So, formulated in terms of properties, the principle would say if to be F is to be G, then the property of being F is identical in the usual sense with the property of being G. But recall that as I don't want to say that these statements make reference to any property, this is not the official mechanical way of reading this symbol here. So I'm going to talk about property identity or generic identity for when talking about this symbol. But bear in mind that I don't mean literally identity between properties taken as objects. Okay, all right. Then the priority principle, PP, it says that if to be F is to be G, then being G is metaphysically prior to or more fundamental than being F. Okay, and I'm using this symbol to express this idea of metaphysical priority or relative fundamentality. Okay. Now, given these two principles, you can perhaps already see that you have a conflict. You have problems. Okay. So I'm presenting the problem as follows, as a paradox. Okay. So maybe there's no real paradox here. Okay. So on one hand, there seems to be correct real definitions. Okay. You might take that for granted, but there's an argument that shows you that there cannot possibly be a real definition, correct real definition. Okay. And the argument is the following. So it's an argument by reductio. So suppose that there's one correct real definition, say to be F is to be G. Okay. Then by IP and PP, you have that, what, points 2 and 3 on the slide. If to be F is to be G, then being F and being G are one the same. And if to be F is to be G, then being G is prior to being F. Okay. Now, let me introduce two further principles which are going to lead us to a contradiction. Point 4 is an instance, or is supposed to be an instance, of Leibniz's law for this identity connective. Okay. So if to be F, if being F and being G are one and the same, and if being F is prior to being G is prior to being F, then being F is prior to itself. Okay. And the further principle is that it's not the case that being F is prior to itself, and it might involve the irreflexivity of metaphysical priority here. Okay. Now, given these five items, then you can derive contradictions quite straightforwardly. So by 1 and 2, you get that being F and being G are all the same. By 1 and 3, you get that being G is prior to being F, and by 4, 6, and 7, you get that being F is prior to itself. And this gives you a contradiction with line 5. So the conclusion of the argument is that it's not the case that to be F is to be G. Okay. So given that to be F, that's, you know, the F and G were supposed to be arbitrary, what the argument in effect shows is that there cannot be any correct real definition. And that's the paradox, because intuitively there are correct real definitions. Okay. All right, so here what we have, what generates the contradiction are these four statements from 2 to 5. Okay, so if you want to stick to the idea that there are correct real definitions, you have to reject at least one of these statements. Okay. So these are four ways out. So one would be to deny the irreflexivity of metaphysical priority. Now, I take that to be a bad news. So some people would say, well, obviously, metaphysical priority is irreflexive. Now, you might think that there are some, you know, special cases involving, you know, self-reference or some other phenomena that will deliver some cases of, you know, reflexive priority, things prior to themselves. But even if that's true, then it's going to be, I mean, self-priority is only going to occur in very special cases. Okay, so these are, okay. The second way out is to reject the identity principle, okay? And I honestly cannot see how you could do that, okay? So I take it, for instance, that stipulative definitions, so like the usual definition of group, gives us true, real definitions, okay? But at the same time, property, identity, okay? So you might think if that's the case for these special real definitions, which are the stipulative definitions, why should not that be the case for all cases of real definitions? Third option, reject the priority principle. And actually, this is a view I could be sympathetic to for the following reason. What I've called property identities, that is to say statements of that kind, okay, you can call them real definitions of some kind, okay? Because, well, you should read that as being F and being G are the same, so sounds like a real definition of some sort. And definitely, property identities violate the priority principle, if only for the reason that, well, that notion is reflexive, so, you know, being F and being F are one and the same. But again, what this would yield is massive cases of self-priority, and we don't want that. Okay. All right, but the point here is that I'm interested in another kind of real definition for which the principle should work. So I would be ready to grant that, you know, these property identities give you some sort of real definitions, but there's another notion of real definition, which is really the focus of my presentation. Okay. Now, the last possible way out is to deny that the purported instance of Leibniz's law, so this is the guy here that we've used in the revision, is in fact an instance of the law, and I think that this is the right one. So I'm going to explain to you why. Okay. So let me say a bit more about property identity on one hand and metaphysical priority on the other hand. Okay. Stressed before, I don't take property identity, which I also call Alex Sky's generic identity. I do not take that to be proper standard identity between properties. Okay, so this symbol is not a predicate. Okay, expressing identity, it's an operator. Okay, that takes predicates as arguments. Even though it's not standard identity, it behaves somehow like identity. It's reflexive, symmetric, and transitive. Okay. I take it to be hyper-intentional, so ID part from Agustin Arroyo. So in his book on the construction of logical space, he studies these generic identities, these just-is statements, as he calls them, and he takes the notion of, the relevant notion of an identity to be not to be hyper-intentional, okay? So I and Alex would disagree with that. So for instance, we think that it's not true that being F and being F and geology are one and the same, okay? There is a connection between generic or property identity and modality and mutual necessitation. So if being F and being G are one and the same, then as a matter of necessity, something is F, if only if it's G, okay, but the converse does not hold, okay, because otherwise the notion of property identity would not be hyper-intentional. Okay. So here we have some references. Kiando has a recent paper of 100 and something pages that just appeared last week. It used to be just a draft. It has been in the form of a draft for 10 years or something like that, and now it's published. And he has a lot to say about this notion of property identity or generic identity as well. Okay. All right. Now, priority. Okay. So, I wish to give two suggestions about how to understand that notion of metaphysical priority or relative fundamentality. Okay. So, on one view, on one of the suggestions, by priority here we just mean grounding. So you should read being F is prior to being G as being F grounds being G. Okay. Now, this is not exactly the usual notion of grounding, because the usual notion of grounding that people like Feinrosen and others talk about and use is not generic, it's factual. So the form of these grounding claims is almost that one. It's being the case that P makes it the case that Q, or again, the fact that P grounds the fact that Q. So here, the statements of interest are quite different. It's being F grounds being G, so that's why I call them generic and not factual. Okay. So in a very recent paper, Fine acknowledges the intelligibility of these generic grounding statements. Anyway, so that's the notion I'm talking about here. Very importantly, I take the target notion, so the one that's used in the account of real definition, to be representational as opposed to worldly. Okay. So what do I mean by that? So if you talk in terms of, let's talk in terms of properties to simplify matters, worldly grounding would relate properties, okay, worldly properties. Representational grounding would relate concepts or notions or words or something like that, okay. So that's the relevant contrast here, okay. And very importantly for my account, the notion of grounding that's supposed to be used in the account of the definition must be representational as opposed to worldly. Okay. So here you have some examples of differences between a worldly conception of grounding and a representational conception of grounding regarding particular cases. So Fine, for instance, would take this to be a correct grounding statement, being F grounds being not F, so he has a representational notion in mind. On a worldly conception of grounding, you would deny that, because you would say, well, being F and being not F, they just point to the same property. Okay, so different concepts, different notions, if you want, but same property. Same thing with the second example. Okay. Fine or Rosen would say, yes, of course, being H2O ground is being water. But if you have a worldly conception of grounding, you say no, because being H2O and being water point to the very same property, different concepts, but same property. Okay. And here you have further example. So in this case, the worldly and the representational conceptions could agree, being red, grounds being red, or square. And in the very last case, so maybe it's not so important, but on Fine's specific logic of grounding, this cannot be true. Whereas on the worldly conception of grounding, this is okay, because being not red again is the same as. So the example boils down to the example on the previous slide. Okay. All right, so what's important here is really to keep in mind that this distinction, which you can formulate in terms of properties if you want. Worldly grounding relates properties. Representational grounding relates representations, concepts, or notions, or words if you want. Okay. Here is another suggestion for understanding metaphysical priority in the context of an account of real definition. This is the following: understand being F grounds being G as predicate F, or the notion of being F is more joint carving than predicate G, or the notion of being G. Okay. So here I indirectly refer to Ted Sider's work on being joint carving, as he likes to say, on being structural. Okay. So in his book, he has he actually uses such a notion. One very important thing here is that the notion that we need for the account of real definition is a comparative notion. So it's being more joint carving than, okay. So his own notion is is not comparative, it's absolute. So either you're structural or John Calvin or you're not. Okay. We need the comparative notion. Okay. All right, so to give you examples, you might think that, well, the two predicates or notions, being H or being also describe the same aspect of reality, but the first one is more joint carving than the second because it tells us more about the structure of that aspect. Okay, it goes deeper in the structure of the aspect. Okay, and you might also think that being red and being not red describe the same aspect of reality, but the first one is more joint carving than the second because it describes the aspect more directly, okay, in this case. So that would be illustrations of this idea of being more joint carving than. Okay. So here's my account of real definition. If you put the identity principle and the priority principle together, then you get this conditional. If to be F is to be G, then being F and being G are one and the same, and being G is prior, metaphysically prior than being F. I simply wish to suggest to take the other direction on hold and to claim that to be F is to be G. That's equivalent to the conjunction of being F is and being G are one the same, and being G is prior to being F. Okay, so that's the suggestion. Okay. So let me go back to the paradox, okay? So I told you when you know, talking about the possible ways out paradox that the fourth suggestion was, according to me, the best one. Okay. So the argument made use of a purported instance of Leibniz's law, this one, if being F and being G are one and the same, and if being G is prior to being F, then being F is prior to itself. So given my suggestions for understanding both, you know, generic identity or property identity and metaphysical priority, you can see that this is not at all an instance of the law. Okay. There are two ways, at least two ways of, elaborating on that point. So one is in terms of properties, so that's the easiest way. And the thought is the following. So that statement, being F is prior to being G is prior to being F, expresses a relation between representations of properties, say predicates or notions, okay, not merely a relation between properties, worldly properties. Okay, so the case is really similar to the Quine's Giorgione example. Okay, so the statement Giorgione was so cool because of his size is not merely about Giorgione; it's also about his name. Okay, that name. So the situation is exactly the same here. So just like in the case of Giorgione, you don't have, I mean, Leibniz's law could not apply, okay? Here as well, the law is ineffective. Okay. In more neutral terms, so without, you know, talking about properties, you could say, well, the truth value of statements of priority is more sensitive to the representational content of predicates F and G than the truth value of these identity statements, okay? So the thought here would be that, you know, very, very roughly speaking, this notion of property identity really concerns the worldly states of affairs, if you want. Okay. Whereas metaphysical priority, as I understood it for the purpose of the account, doesn't just concern worldly states of affairs. It also concerns representations of states of affairs. Okay. So that's essentially, that's the thought, why you cannot, you know, Leibniz's law doesn't apply to these notions in the way suggested. Okay. All right. Okay. So this is again the account. To be F is to be G is equivalent to first being F and being G are being the same. And second, being G is prior, metaphysically prior to being F. I've proposed two ways of understanding metaphysical priority. And the conjecture I wish to put forward is that, in fact, the two proposed interpretations of metaphysical priority yield exactly the same account, or at least yield equivalent to Kant. So whether you work with representational grounding or with the notion of being more joint causal than, well, that doesn't matter because the accounts, the two accounts will be equivalent. Okay. So where does that conjecture, how can we establish that conjecture? Well, this conjecture follows from another conjecture, namely that if the statement being F and being G are one and the same is true, then being F grounds being G is true if and only if predicate G or the notion of being G is more John Conving than the notion of being F or predicate F. Okay. So this is actually what I want to show in the appendix if I have time to do it. Okay. So in a way that's a nice thing because well you have that that kind of general a bit vague notion of metaphysical priority. I propose two different ways of precisifying the notion, one in terms of grounding, the other one in terms of being John Conving. And it turns out that these two options boil down to the same in the context of an account of definition. All right. Okay, so a few words about the links between so-called conceptual analysis and real definition. Okay. So I think it's a very plausible view that correct conceptual analysis, like to be a Dixon is to be a female fox, induce real definitions. In this case, to be Vixen is, in the sense of real definition, to be a female fox. That can be known a priori to be correct. Okay. So that seems to me to be a fairly plausible claim about the connection between conceptual analysis and real definition. Now, you might want to make a stronger claim, namely that a correct conceptual analysis just is a real definition that can be known a priori to be correct. Okay. And I also find that second claim plausible. Okay. But I must tell you, I've never really worked a lot on conceptual analysis, so I might be completely wrong here. Okay. Now, so you are certainly familiar with the so-called paradox of conceptual analysis. So focus on this example, the example of Vixen. The paradox is the following. So on one hand, we want a correct conceptual analysis to be informative. Okay, it must not be a trivial statement, it must give us some information. But there's also the other view that if a conceptual analysis of that kind, say that one, is correct, then to be a vixen and to be a female fox must mean the very same thing. Okay, and then there's the thought, well, if really what you have on the left of is and what you have on the right really have the very same meaning, how can a state corresponding statement be informative at all? Okay. So that's the part. So in the framework I've put forward, so where you claim that you take conceptual analysis to be boil down to real definitions, essentially. Then what can we say? Now, there are basically two views, and again, I might be extremely ignorant of the literature of conceptual analysis here. There are basically two views about what to do to escape the paradox of analysis. One is to say, well, actually, in this example, Vixen and female fox have different meanings. Okay, so it's not true. So one assumption that gave rise to the paradox is just wrong. Okay, they have different meanings. Okay, so that's one way out, and I think that's one way out that you can read Frege at some point in his life as somehow advocating at least indirectly that view. Okay. So on that view, you could say that. Metaphysical priority grounding, for instance, would operate on meanings in this setting. Okay, given that you have distinct meanings, then there's no problem in saying, well, one meaning, so to speak, grounds the other one. Okay. Now, there's another option to escape the paradox analysis, which is to say, well, in one sense, they have the same meaning, but in another sense, they have different meanings. Okay, so the view boils down, in effect, to the view that, well, there are two levels of meaning. The two predicates have the same meaning at one level, but they have different meanings on another level. So it turns out that this is also something that you can, a view that you can attribute to Frege at some other point of his life. So one thing could be, well, I mean, leaving aside Frege and the exact Frege terminology, would be to say, well, they have, let's say, the same content, these two predicates. There are various ways of carving up, you know, that of cutting the contents into pieces, and that gives you different meanings too, okay, something like that. So what about the details here? Definitely you cannot take metaphysical priority to operate on meanings one, because they are the same meanings, but you can definitely say that they operate, the notion operate on meanings two. Okay. But again, this might be just completely super problematic given my knowledge of the literature on the paradox of analysis. Okay, so you could perhaps then. Okay. So here are some features of the accounts of real definition. Obviously, the identity principle and the priority principle are satisfied. Okay. Real definitions are reflexive. Okay, so basically, if 2BF is 2BG, we cannot have that 2BG is 2BF. Okay. If 2BF, we cannot have 2BF is 2BF, basically. And that's because metaphysical priority is reflexive. Okay. It is transitive, okay, because both property identity and metaphysical priority are transitive. So if 2BF is 2BG, 2BG is 2BH, then 2BF is 2BH. There's a clear connection, at least according to me, between not according to Alex, my co-writer. There's a clear connection between between real definition and essence, which is given, which is yielded by the notion of property identity. Because I take that notion to be an essentialist notion. So a statement of type being F is being G, or being F and being G are one and the same, tells us something about what it is to be F, and also about what it is to be G. Okay. And a final point I wish to mention, which might be taken to be a bad consequence of the account, is that the definiendum in a real definition need not be syntactically simple. So given very plausible assumptions, you will have to say that to be not F, okay, is in the sense of real definition to be F. Okay. But maybe we can talk about that aspect of the view during the Q&A. So I wish to now to comment on two recent accounts of real definition, one given by Gideon Rosen and another one given by Kit Fine. Okay. So I don't think these accounts are correct, and I'm going to tell you why. So Rosen has a very special take on real definitions. So first he takes a real definition to take the form which you see here on the slides. So it's basically real definition is a predication, a relational predication. Def here is expresses, say, a relation between a property and what he calls a complex. Okay, so complexes should not be taken to be property. They are not properties. So we have two different ontological categories here. And he tells us that what he means by complex is basically what Russell meant when he talked about structured propositional functions. Okay. All right. So that's the shape a real definition should have according to Rosen. So just to illustrate, you could say, well, that's the real definition to be water is to be H2O, should be understood as the property of being water is defined as the complex X is H2O or something like that. Okay. All right. Okay, so here's his account, and that's a pretty complicated account of real definition. So he takes So that's the way he understands def f of f and phi. So this is an essentialist operator. Should be read. It's true in virtue of the nature of f, okay, the property f, that anything that exemplifies for any x, if x exemplifies the property f or exemplifies the complex phi, then the fact that x exemplifies phi grounds the fact that x exemplifies f. So that's his positive suggestion. Okay. And so this symbol here is used for grounding, basically, you know, a standard representation or notion of grounding that Feynman and Rosen like. Okay. So what could we say against the account? So one thing is, well, it's too complicated. Okay. it cannot be right. So that's not very serious. The more serious objection would be to say, well, look, I mean, you need to introduce, you know, two different ontological categories. So that of the category of properties is okay. Many people talk about it. You know, your account needs to, you know, invoke that other category of complexes. So first question, what are complexes? Okay. Second, should really an account of redefinition, you know, invoke such entities of such a category? All right, so might be unhappy because of such reasons. So here I mention one perhaps more important reason why I don't take the account to be satisfactory. The identity principle is not satisfied on that view. Okay. Rosen is explicit that if you have f, if say the complex phi provides a real definition of the property f, then the property f of being f must be distinct from the complex phi. Okay. So you don't have an identity here, whereas according to the identity principle, you might think, well, you should have an identity in this context. Okay. Now, Rosen is aware of the difficulty, and he makes a claim. Actually, the claim is defended at length. The claim is that if complex phi defines property f, then property f is identical with the property of satisfying phi. So f is not identical to phi, it's identical to the property of satisfying phi, but only if you take properties to be individuated intentionally, okay, so coarse-grainedly. Okay. So that's the best thing I can get on his account. Okay. Now, one reaction here is that, well, that's not what we want. Okay, so we want property identity for properties individuated hyper-intentionally, not merely intentionally. Okay. So I want to say, for instance, that the property of being water is the property of being H2O, where I understand these two, you know, locutions as pointing to the very same property understood, individuated hyper-intentionally. So let me now move to Fine's account. So Fine's account is much simpler. Okay. So he says, well, to be F is to be G, that's equivalent to the conjunction of two statements. The second one is actually the same as in my account, if you understand metaphysical priority as grounding. So here, just like in my account, you have a generic notion of grounding. Okay. But the difference lies in the first conjunct. So where I have property identity or generic identity, he has an essentialist connection between being G and being F, which is being G is essential to being F. So a lot should be said about how Fine understands this essentialist notion here, and he says a lot in the paper. So I won't have time to, you know, to go through. Perhaps most importantly, we should bear in mind that so he understands grounding as representational, so just in the same way as I do for the account, but he also understands essence as representational. So for instance, he would say that being F is essential to being F and F, okay? Whereas you might think, well, being F and being F and F just express the very same property. Okay, so he has a representational notion of essence as well as a representational notion of grounding. Okay, so again, on that view, I think that the problem, the main problem is that the identity principle is not satisfied. You don't get property identity out of that, that account. So I didn't manage to find an intuitive counterexample, so I come up with a nasty logical example. And perhaps it's not very convincing, I don't know. So here's the reason why, a reason why the identity principle is not satisfied. Okay. So on Fine's account, given any F and G, being F is going to ground in the relevant sense, being F and F or G. Okay. And that actually follows by his favorite logic of ground. Now, the second line in the argument is very plausible, given that Fine understands essence as representational. Being F is essential to being F and something else, namely, in this case, being F and F or G. Okay. If you combine these two claims, then you get that on his account of real definition, to be F and F or G is to be F. Okay. And I claim that, well, at least for some F and G, so take F being F as being red and G being G as being square, let's say. It's simply not true that being F and F or G and being F are the same. Okay. You could use the very same example to object to the account without appealing to the identity principle by saying simply, well, it's intuitively not the case that for all F and G being to be F and F or G is to be F. But I'm not sure, so sure about that. All right. Okay. Okay, so throughout the presentation, I focused on real definitions of the form to be F is to be G, where F and G are monadic predicates. So you can obviously generalize that to polyadic predicates. Okay. To be related by relation R, to be R related, is to be S related, let's say. So that's a more general. That's another form of a real definition we can take. So the extension to the polyadic case is not problematic. You can also extend the accounts to factual real definitions to be the case that A is to be the case that B. You can do that very easily as well, okay, given the conceptual tools that I've used in the accounts of the monadic generic case. What about real definitions of type to be A is to be B, where A and B are singular terms or, you know, denoting expressions more generally? You know, like to be the number one is to be the successor of the number two, or whatever. So it's not completely straightforward, but there's an intuitive, plausible situation which is to invoke the generic notion. So understand to be A is to be B as to be identical to A is to be identical to B. So you reduce that case to the case I've discussed throughout the presentation. Okay? All right. So that's basically the core of the presentation. Maybe I can go through the appendix. So focus on the proposed account of statements of type to be F is to be G. My suggestion was that, well, you should understand that as the conjunction of two claims. First, being F and being G are one the same. Okay, that's, you see, a generic identity, property identity. And then being F, being G is prior to being F. Then what I did is suggest two ways of understanding being prior. Okay, so you understand that as grounding or as being more joint carving that. Okay. And then I say, well, the two accounts are actually equivalent. And then what I want to do in the appendix is precisely to establish that the two accounts are equivalent. Okay, so first, a brief detour via Fine's truth-maker semantics for grounding. So Fine introduces a new semantic framework called truth-maker semantics, which he uses for many purposes. So for the theory of grounding, for the logic of grounding, but also, you know, for intuitionistic logic, for, you know, many applications. The basic elements of the semantics are facts, okay? Really worldly facts. There is supposed to be an operation of fusion on facts. So if you have fact F and fact G, you fuse them and you get essentially the fact that F and G, well, it's like a conjunctive fact, okay? So that's what there is at the level of the ontology of the semantics. And then you have a semantic relation of verification, which he calls exact verification. So exact verification is not like verification in the usual possible world semantics, because if a fact F exactly verifies a statement P, then F should be wholly relevant to the verification of P. And what that means is that there's no part of the fact F that is completely irrelevant to verification or the truth of P. So impossible standard possible world semantics, that's that the relation between worlds and statements is not of that kind. A world will make true certain statements without being wholly relevant to the truth of the statement. Many parts of the world in general will be completely irrelevant to the truth of the statement. So he's working with the notion of exact verification, okay? And that's crucial to the semantics. Now, in Guide to Ground and the Pure Logic of Ground, he exploits truth-maker semantics to provide semantics for a language that has grounding operators, okay? So he distinguishes many different notions of grounding: full, partial, weak, strict, so we won't go into the details here. The notion that's going to be of interest for us is the notion of weak grounding. I call it worldly. And that's defined semantically as follows. So A weakly grounds B. That's true if and only if every fact that verifies A also verifies B. Okay. So it's semantically speaking, it's a fairly simple notion. Weak grounding. Okay. All right. Now I wish to suggest that. Exact verification is nice, but fitting descriptions are better. and I'm going to explain why. So in a recent paper, I did reformulate the truth maker semantics in terms of the notion of a fitting description. Okay, and I think it's useful for two reasons I'm going to mention a little bit later. What is a fitting description of a fact F? Well, that's a fitting description of the fact that ignores no part of F. Okay, so there's a relevant condition here. Now, if you take it that a fact F exactly verifies a fact P, and only if P is a fitting description of that fact F, then Fine's characterization of weak grounding can be translated as follows. So A is a weak ground for B. That's true if and only if every fact that is fittingly described by A is also fittingly described by B. So up to now, this is just mere reformulation of Fine semantics, using different words, you might think. One interesting thing about the notion of a fitting description is that fitting descriptions can be more or less perspicuous, okay? And it's not clear that you can, you know, translate that notion of being more or less perspicuous in the language of exact verification. So, for instance, the statement X is colored, you might think, is a less perspicuous description of the fact that X is crimson than the statement X is red. Okay, so we have one fact and two fitting descriptions. One is more perspicuous than the other. Okay, similarly, you have the fact that X is H2O. The statement X is water is a less perspicuous description of that fact than the statement X is H2O. And then I give you two other examples. Okay. All right. Now, given this extension of the framework, okay, so where you don't only talk about feeling descriptions, but you talk about this feeling descriptions that can be more or less perspicuous, then you can give a nice account of grounding, of notion of grounding that Fine likes, okay, notion of strict grounding. So recall the account of weak worldly grounding. A weakly grounds B, that's true if and only if every fact fittingly described by A is also fittingly described by B. Now, here is a suggestion for understanding strict, not weak, strict representational grounding. Okay. A is a strict ground for B in that relevant representational sense. That's true if and only if every fact fittingly described by A is fittingly described by B, but less perspicuously. Okay. So you see from this characterization that if A is a strict ground for B, then it's going to be a weak ground for B automatically. Okay. All right. So you can check the suggestion, the characterization with examples. So the characterization will deliver the result that, you know, the fact that X is red grounds in that strict representational sense, the fact that X is colored, the fact that X is H2O is going to ground, the fact that X is water and so on. Okay. All right. So in these slides, I've only talked about what I call factual grounding. So, you know, the fact that P grounds, the fact that Q. That's not what I am primarily interested in, because real definitions, at least those I've been talking about at the beginning, are generic and not factual in character. Okay, but the thing is that you can really take the whole framework, modify it, and get what you want. So essentially the idea is that instead of talking about facts, you talk about features. Instead of talking about fact fusion, you talk about feature fusion. And instead of talking about fitting descriptions of facts, you talk about fitting descriptions of features. Okay, so that's another respect in which the notion of a fitting description is better than the notion of a verification, exact verification. Okay, you cannot talk about verifying a predicate. It doesn't mean anything in this context. Okay. So you can really go through what I've done in the previous slide. So you characterize a generic weak notion of grounding. Like that, I'm not going to insist on this one. And then you have the suggestion, which is important here, of a notion of generic strict representation. So being F grounds being G in that representational sense, and that's the sense of interest to us for the purpose of accounting for real definitions. So that's true if and only if every feature fittingly described by F is fittingly described by G, but less perspicuously. Okay. Now, given all that, then we can establish the conjecture that I've made a while ago. Okay. So recall the conjecture. If a statement of type being F and being G are one and the same is true, then being F grounds being G, that's true if and only if predicate F is more John Carving than G. So that was the conjecture. So basically, the previous material gives you everything you need to establish that very conjecture. Okay. So how does that work? Well, there are two claims. One, which I've used in the recent paper I've mentioned before. So a statement of type being F and being G are one and the same is true if and only if predicates F and G fittingly describe the very same features. Okay. Then the second claim is that if that's the case, that is, if predicate F and predicate G fittingly describe the same features, then F is more joint carving than G, if and only if every feature fittingly described by F is fittingly described by G, but less perspicuously. Okay. So this is an extra claim that's used here. Okay. Now, given these two claims and the proposed account of representational grounding, which I've just given, then the conjecture straightforwardly follows. Okay. All right, so that's the suggestion. So there was a lot in these slides. I'm sorry about that. We can go back to any points you want. I've really made extensive use of the framework of truthmaker semantics, and obviously if you're not familiar with that, then probably that would have been a bit too fast. Okay. So that's basically all. So really the talk was in two parts. So the first one I tried to defend, to present and defend an account of real definition in terms of property identity and metaphysical priority. And then I gave two possible interpretations of the notion of metaphysical priority. And what I did in the appendix is try to show that, well, whatever the two interpretations actually give, yield equivalent accounts of real definition.